I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio, 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live.
Hello, and welcome to the Prison Voices Project. I am your host, Corey Fisher Hoffman. Thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you so much to our listeners, our volunteers, our programmers, and all of the people that helped contribute to this recent pledge drive and made it so that we are still on the air here at WGXC broadcasting from Columbia and Greene counties. So thank you so much, everyone who contributed in their various ways and helped to raise the total of $37,930 above the goal, which was needed to keep this radio station on the air. And so we really appreciate your support. And I am grateful to be here broadcasting on WGXC 90.7 FM or maybe on WGXC.org, the Prison Voices Project. Thanks for tuning in. Today's show is going to be featuring Associate Professor Jeff Ward as he talks about a movement he calls the Black Child Savers Movement, an early movement from the 1890s through the 1960s that worked to address the unequal and separate treatment of youth of color in the criminal justice system. So before we start, let's listen to some music. This is Save the Children by Marvin Gaye.
I just want to ask a question. Who really cares? Save a world in despair. Who really cares? There'll come a time.
There'll come a time
when the world won't be singing.
When the world won't be singing.
Flowers won't grow.
Flowers won't grow. No.
Bells won't be ringing.
No bells won't be ringing.
Who really cares?
Who really cares?
Who's willing to try?
Who is willing to try?
To save a world.
To save a world.
That's destined to
that
die.
That is destined to die.
When I look at the world.
When I look at the world.
It fills me with sorrow.
It fills me with sorrow.
Little children today.
Children today.
Really gonna suffer tomorrow.
Really suffer tomorrow.
Oh, what a shame.
What a shame.
Such a bad way to
Such
live.
Such a bad way to live.
Oh, who is to blame?
Who is to blame?
We can't stop
when
living.
When we can't stop living. Oh, oh.
Live.
Live.
Live. Live.
Live for life.
Life.
Live life for the children.
Live
See, let's save the children. Let's save all the children.
Save the babies. Save the babies. And if you want to love, you got love. Save the babies. Oh, I want to feel. You got feeling. You will save the babies. All of the children. Bye. Yeah, to save our world, yeah, save our sweet world, save a world that is destined to die.
That was Save the Children by Marvin Gaye, and you are listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. Thanks so much for tuning in. So as you might have heard at the beginning of this program, you can write to us if you would like to participate in this program and send letters. We'll read them on the air. You can write to us at 704 Columbia Street, second floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. And next Wednesday, October 30th, from 7 to 9 p.m., there will be a letter writing night where volunteers will come together at the Hudson Studio once again at 704 Columbia Street in Hudson, New York, on the second floor, and join in responding to some of the letters that we've received at the Prison Voices Project from incarcerated listeners throughout Greene and Columbia counties. So if you are available to come from 7 to 9 p.m. on Wednesday, October 30th, it would be great to see you there. We ask that volunteers bring first-class postage stamp or snacks to share. And you can take part in creating radio that moves beyond bars. And so for those of you who are listening from the inside, also send us a letter, and that way we'll know to send you one of our fall newsletters giving updates about what's going to come in the future programming for the Prison Voices Project and sharing some information about past programs and topics that we've covered in the past. So write to us. You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on 90.7 FM, WGXC. And today's program is focused on a talk that was given by Jeff Ward, who's associate professor in criminology at University of Irvine in California. He came to Hudson, New York to speak about his new book, The Black Child Savers. This is a book that talks about people who are organizing a movement to work for reform and changes in the Jim Crow juvenile justice system. So we'll begin by playing the first segment of his talk, and thanks so much to Emily Truitt, who co-produced this piece. Thanks for tuning into the Prison Voices Project, and here it is.
Today, it is well known that there are stark racial disparities in the criminal justice and the juvenile justice system, but the movement to address these disparities is not a new one. Jeff Ward, Associate Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine, came to Hudson on August 8th to discuss his recently published book called The Black Child Savers, Racial Democracy and Juvenile Justice. The event was organized by the Prison Public Memory Project and the Hudson Area Library. Ward's presentation focused on the movement to address racial disparities in the Jim Crow juvenile justice system, and specifically, the movement's efforts in New York City and along the Hudson River in the 1930s. Local scholars, media makers, interested community members, and people working for reform in the juvenile justice system today attended the event.
You know, I was finding material that suggested, that indicated how Jim Crow juvenile justice actually manifested. And I was also finding material related to the Black Child Saving Movement, or the opposition to that Jim Crow juvenile justice system. And that became fascinating to me, and very clearly evident to me that that was really the important story to study. And so I spent the next several years and then many more years writing that as a dissertation and then later as a book.
The book that Jeff Ward is referring to is called The Black Child Savers, Racial Democracy and Juvenile Justice. Ward recently received a prestigious award in criminology, the Hindeling Award, for that book. In the next clip, Jeff Ward explains the Black Child Saving Movement and how it developed out of a desire to racially integrate the juvenile justice system and uplift the African American community.
African Americans were invested in the idea of the manufactory of citizens. They saw the juvenile court, in theory, in juvenile reformatory institutions, as potentially vital resources to address problems affecting Black youth, families, and communities. Resources that could make healthcare available, education available, basic security available to Black youth. And through the rehabilitation of Black youth, they thought a more general racial uplift would potentially ensue. And so the Black Child Saving Movement, which begins in the 1890s and lasts at least through the 1960s, was very specifically pushing for access to institutions, was actually pushing to increase Black representation in juvenile institutions over the course of the 20th century. The movement unfolded in two waves, and I want to talk about those waves. The initial wave begins in the 1890s with Black club women in the South essentially declaring war against Jim Crow juvenile justice, what they call the slavery of an inequitous justice system. Slavery in the sense that the underdevelopment of Black youth would by definition entail the generational underdevelopment of Black Americans. One reformer in the more contemporary period has described this as a kind of genocide. She called it killing the seeds of a people through their underdevelopment. And so beginning in the 1890s, extremely marginalized Black women who among in Black civil society were relatively prominent. They had some education. Many of them were graduates of Black colleges. They had some economic means, although little. They had no political leverage really to speak of. And so they engaged in a very kind of self-help oriented intervention between 1890s and 1920s, where they would do things like buy dilapidated structures in places in the rural South, and most of the South was still very rural in this period, and they would simply define it as a reformatory for Black youth, and they would go over to the juvenile court or to the court that dealt with juvenile cases and say, look, no need to continue sending our children to the prison or to the chain gang. We have just launched a reformatory of our own. Send them to us. We'll take them in. We'll do the rehabilitative ideal ourselves. They were essentially translating racial uplift ideology, the industrial education models that they were familiar with through places like Tuskegee and Hampton, other Black colleges, and translating that into a kind of rehabilitative program.
You just heard Jeff Ward, Associate Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine, talk about the Black Child Savers, a movement to create racial uplift and end the separate and unequal policies of the Jim Crow juvenile justice system. This movement began in the 1890s in the South and spread up South to the racially segregated and unequal North through much of the 20th century. Ward spoke at the Hudson Library in August at an event co-sponsored by the Prison Public Memory Project. The Prison Public Memory Project uses history, dialogue, the arts, and technology to build public memory and safe spaces where people from all walks of life can come together to engage in conversation and learning about the complex and contested role of prisons in communities and society. In this next segment, Jeff Ward talks about what he calls the Black Child Savers Movement and how it developed in the 1930s with the work of Jane Boleyn, a Poughkeepsie resident and leader in the movement for racial justice in the juvenile justice system and beyond.
The movement evolved dramatically after the 1930s for a lot of reasons, but its evolution really is significant in a few senses. One is that it became a national movement, and it became a much more explicitly politicized movement, a movement to eliminate separate and unequal juvenile justice rather than dampen its impact on communities, as the earlier wave had intended. The movement became national in part through the migration of Black Americans, particularly to urban centers like New York City, Detroit, and Chicago, and the emergence of a Black professional class, and large other Black institutions, the Black press, for example, Black professional associations, that became vehicles, really, for the development of a much larger and more explicitly politicized and impactful movement. Jane Bolin was the emblematic figure of this second wave. Bolin was born in Poughkeepsie in 1908. She was the youngest child of an activist father. Her father was head of Poughkeepsie's NAACP branch. Her mother was a white woman born to English parents in Ireland, and her mother died when Jane Bolin was 8 years old. So she was largely raised by her father and her older brother, both of whom were instrumental in Poughkeepsie local politics. Bolin was an incredible figure. I'm just curious, out of curiosity, here I am in, you know, a nearby city. Not very often have I been in this situation. How many of you are familiar with Jane Bolin already? Just by show of hands, quickly. At all. I mean, how many of you have never heard of Jane Bolin until today? This is incredible when you consider that Bolin was the first Black woman judge in the United States. She was the first Black graduate of Yale Law School. These are the kinds of first things. This is what I'm saying. Not that we should all be invested in the sort of celebration of first so much, but it's interesting that we don't know her as well as we know so many other. And I guess we can only, you know, there are like five people that everyone knows, you know, Rosa Parks, and, you know, but Bolin should be added to that list. She was a remarkable figure. Let me just give you some highlights from her life. Bolin became involved in politics very early on. I mentioned her upbringing by a political activist father. In 1923, now 15 years old, Jane Bolin sent a letter to Poughkeepsie's Daily Newspaper, 15 years old, protesting its failure to capitalize the word Negro, its practice of racial and ethnic identification, only in matters involving Black Americans that put them in a negative light. And the, quote, use of a Southern dialect in all its reporting about Black persons, which I can only think meant it's racist language, but she was using Southern dialect in 1923 because to write a letter declaring that Poughkeepsie Daily News was racist would have been probably a dangerous thing to do for a 15-year-old and just about anyone else. Of course, the newspaper continued with its racialized reporting practices, but Bolin would continue to write letters. In fact, I'm going to tell you more about some of those letters she's written to various people, because they're just illustrative to me of her, how amazing she was. So Bolin goes on to go to law school, and she left Poughkeepsie because she said her future would be extinguished in Poughkeepsie. She was drawn, like many, to the city. And in New York, she began practicing law in juvenile defense, representing indigent kind of indigent cases in the family court, and was nominated for a judgeship in New York City along the time, around the period of the Harlem Rebellion, at which point there was mounting pressure to increase Black representation among legal and other authorities. And so Bolin was tapped to for a position on the Manhattan Juvenile Court, which she held from 1939 to 1979. And from that position, Bolin was able to exact a unique kind of damage on the sort of built environment of Jim Crow juvenile justice. As an insider, she was able to exact a unique kind of pressure that forced that system to bend in certain ways, in break in some respects. One of the first things she noticed when she got to the Manhattan Court was that the subtle practice of Jim Crow juvenile justice in New York City, you know, in the South, there would just be an outright sort of dismissal of black youth's claims to services and black families' claims to services. In Manhattan, it was different in the late 30s and early 40s. There, caseworkers would put a mark in the corner of a case file that indicated that this involved a black or Puerto Rican kid, and therefore signaled that they were ineligible for commitment to the various private institutions that preferred to only receive white kids. And she discovered this pretty soon into her tenure. She had the chief of probation fired. She fired off letters to city government officials, state officials, declaring that she would not tolerate New York's Jim Crow juvenile justice system. Bowen is also, at the same time, being celebrated, of course, as a first. As I mentioned, we like to do this, you know, Black History Month kind of thing, let's celebrate all the firsts. And so she was invited back to Poughkeepsie, for example, to a dinner celebrating her achievement, her emergence on the bench, and her achievement as the first black woman judge. And she got up before the group, who was, you know, probably having a nice dinner, thinking it was going to be a kind of warm affair. She stood up before them and she said, "All of you are fascists." She said, "You want to celebrate me as a first, but in truth, you don't want any more of me. You want me to be the first today, tomorrow, in 10 years, the first and the last." She said, "There are Negro," I'm quoting her here, "there are Negro and Jewish and Catholic and Chinese, Japanese and Indian youngsters who dream the same dreams I once had and who shoot at the same stars. What will you make democracy mean to them? They too study the Constitution and the history of America. They take seriously the Constitution. And unlike the United States Supreme Court during much of our history, they take it literally. They mean to have liberty and a full, rich life, free of want, oppression, and inequality of opportunity, whether economic, social, or political." So you can imagine how this dinner, people start choking on the bread and stuff. But she was regularly firing off in this way at anyone who approached her. The New York City Red Cross wrote and asked if they would be the token, if she would be their token black member on their board. And she said, "I refuse to serve on your Jim Crow advisory board." Whoa, Jim Crow advisory board. She said, "I'm aware, having served on the court for so long, of your Jim Crow policy." She mentions Booth Memorial Hospital, which is run by the Red Cross at that time. She said, "I'm aware of your Jim Crow policy where you segregate the pregnant Negro girls we refer from the court from the pregnant white girls, and the pregnant Negro girls receive separate and unequal treatment through the hospital." She said, "I refuse to be a part of this Jim Crow setup by being a token member of your advisory board." Bowen, and she wrote letters, I just have to stress this, and I'll move on from the letters because I could read them all day, but she wrote letters to everyone from the President of the United States to local city officials. She reviewed a book by Camille Kelly, a famous Memphis juvenile court judge, and she wrote in the review, "One of the main objectives of children's court," which is, I just have to mention, it's interesting that a sitting judge writes a book review, but she thought it so important to write this. She said, "One of the main objectives of the children's court is the preparation of children appearing before it to become good citizens and to become and to assume the responsibilities of citizenship. Children, however, should charge us with hypocrisy, and justly so, if on becoming voting age they find themselves faced with unprogressive, undemocratic, and outmoded financial restrictions which juvenile court judges themselves have done nothing to abolish." She's writing about Kelly's court, so she's talking about her colleague. Plato might well be paraphrased as, quote, "The punishment suffered by the wise who refuse universal participation in government is to live under the government of bad men and women." So Bowen was a fiery figure, as you might have surmised by now. And that part of her personality, in addition to her stature, was crucial to her status as an emblematic figure in this movement. There have been many since her black judges and other legal officials who do not have the inclination or the instincts or the courage to risk their own interests by challenging the powers among them to live up to their democratic creed. Boland is significant in a more general sense, and here I want to say a little bit more about the New York movement, in that the Black Child Savers envisioned her and others as the kind of instrumental working parts of what would be an institution, what would be institutionalized racial justice.
Was Ballad for Attica Blues, and you're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM, or maybe you're streaming live, wgxc.org. Thanks so much for tuning into the Prison Voices Project. So before continuing with the rest of our segment on Jeff Ward and his talk about the Black Child Savers movement, I wanted to make a couple announcements. So the first announcement is that next Wednesday, October 30th, from 7 to 9 p.m., there will be a letter writing night, an opportunity to respond to many of the letters received by incarcerated listeners in Greene and Columbia counties. And there will also be a mailing of the fall newsletter from the Prison Voices Project, which goes out to a couple of dozen people who are in prisons in New York State who write to the Prison Voices Project, send letters, and send input on how this program should be designed. And sometimes we read those letters on the air. So if you can join us from 7 to 9 p.m. Wednesday, October 30th at 704 Columbia Street, second floor in Hudson, New York, that would be wonderful. You can bring a dish to share, some snacks, or some first-class postage stamp to donate. Another announcement that I want to make is that there's a great opportunity coming up to participate in a project that is put together by Thousand Kites, a group out of Whitesburg, Kentucky. And so the Thousand Kites and WGXC, the Prison Voices Project, invite you to participate in a special holiday radio program for prisoners called Calls from Home. send a message of hope and encouragement to those behind bars in our nation's prisons. Read a short poem, sing a song, or send a blessing. Speak from your heart to the over 2 million people behind bars this holiday season. Your message will be broadcast on radio stations around the country, sending radio waves of hope through prison walls. You can call in your message toll-free at the following two numbers. So get your pen and paper out. So you can call in toll-free at 877-410-4863. That's 877-410-4863. And if you want to find out more information, you can go to callsfromhome.org. So for those of you who are listening, you can call that phone number, leave a message of love and support, and that message will be edited and then broadcast on the radio. It will be broadcast here on WGXC on Thursday, December 26th from 10 to 11 a.m. during the Prison Voices Project show. So take an opportunity to call that message sometime before December 1st. And if you're listening from one of the facilities in the area, from one of the prisons or the jails, you can have family members call in. And I'll give the number one more time. That number is 877-410-4863. And then you can hear their messages on the radio on Thursday, December 26th. So I hope you participate in this incredible project to really break down the barriers that divide us. We're going to continue with a little music before finishing up the second half of the program with Jeff Ward. So this is in theme with today's program on the Black Child Savers Movement. This is Save the Children by Gil Scott-Heron.
Driving through the country on a lazy afternoon. Or you're watching your children playing after school. They seem to be to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Such a small part of the thing that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. We'll be right back.
children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.
We'll continue with a talk that Jeff Ward, Associate Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society, gave in Hudson about the movement for reform of the juvenile justice system. He calls this movement the Black Child Savers Movement. In this next segment, Ward explains how the movement made gains and asserted a political demand for racial justice that extended beyond the juvenile justice system.
So, at the height of the Black Child Saving Movement, around the 1940s and 50s, you had emerging in select locations like New York City, and I can't really find a good example anywhere else of this, these formidable networks of what were called kind of romantically race expert leaders. These were black professionals in various positions of influence, political, legal, social services, community leadership, who had race expertise, not just because they were black, but because of their race consciousness, their commitment to freedom movement. And the idea was that if you network these race expert leaders, the illustration was that by networking these leaders, you could provide unprecedented access to services, unprecedented levels of legal protection, unprecedented degrees of political representation through the workings of these networks. So you have people like W.E.B. Du Bois, who in the crisis is writing about the Black Child Saving Movement around the country. Jane Boland credits Du Bois in her letters, in her papers that are at the Schomburg Institute. There's a very long oral history that she gave, which is fascinating. She credits Du Bois and the crisis with raising her racial consciousness. And she said it was through the crisis that she, and through learning about lynchings and other kinds of racial violence, that she became committed to racial justice and a career in law. So Du Bois is conducting studies. In 1914, the NAACP commissions a study of the relation of the Negro child to the juvenile courts of the United States, a study which, as far as I can tell, was never completed. But you can see how that research, it was research being done by the Urban League in places like Detroit and in New York, documenting separate and unequal juvenile justice. Political figures like Boland, the Clarks, others, community leaders like Janie Barrett, would use that information to exert pressure on the state to document the ordeal of Jim Crow juvenile justice and its harm. Their efforts to exert pressure resulted in, you know, some increases in opportunities and resources, such as investment in Kenneth and Mamie Clark's interventions in Harlem, including Northside Center for Child Development, which was a community-based mental health program focused on addressing poverty and racism as a means of mental health intervention in the Harlem community. The Clarks gained traction in the federal government. And in state government through the efforts of others around them like Boland. So these were taking shape as a kind of the working parts of a model of racial justice that had a legal dimension, a political dimension, a kind of community engagement dimension, a service dimension, working together in a networked kind of way to raise awareness and to assert a kind of pressure that was formidable. And the idea, and it was kind of romantic, like much of the history of juvenile justice, the Black Child Savers had their own romanticism. There was a kind of romantic notion that if you institutionalize this model through the formal integration of legal officials, more black probation officers and judges, more people like the Clarks doing community-based services, continued involvement of social researchers and so forth, that you would effectively institutionalize racial justice in an ongoing sense. When we talk about institutionalized racism, we need to think and talk more, I think, about what institutionalized racial justice would look like. In the absence of that discussion, we have, I think, been subject to this simplified narrative of colorblindness, which, as I'll point out in a moment, is in direct contradiction with this idea that the Black Child Saving Movement generated. One happy ending story, and then I'm going to end with a bunch of dismal points. The happy ending story is that Bolin and her counterparts, Bolin, I forgot to mention, was also the only, for a long time, the only woman on the NAACP's executive board. She eventually resigned from the NAACP, declaring that it too was fascist, and had drifted away from its commitment to local branches and to actually being involved in local struggles. But the Bolin working with the NAACP did succeed in the 1940s in passing legislation, state legislation, declaring institutions that denied access to Black youth ineligible for state support. And so this was, you know, well before Brown, a chink in the armor of Jim Crow juvenile justice. We know that, you know, it didn't translate into institutionalized racial justice, but for her time and for the movement itself, this was a remarkable achievement.
Jeff Ward has been discussing the gains of what he refers to as the Black Child Savers movement. And in the following segment, Ward will explain the limitations of the movement and the work that lies ahead in addressing the racial disparities in the juvenile justice system today.
I argue in my book that the Black Child Saving Movement, while it succeeded in many ways, ultimately failed to institutionalize racial justice. And it failed really for a couple of reasons. One was the way in which post-integration, the idea of the manufacturing of citizens was abandoned. So there was a sort of story here about the integration of a sinking ship, the integration of a juvenile justice model that was being abandoned, and with great speed after the 1960s. Willie Boskett, who was a well-known figure in New York State history, is credited with, superficially, with ushering in the punitive era of Jim Crow juvenile justice, in particular legislation around treating children like adults, which New York State was the first to adopt and in the late 1970s, and every state followed soon thereafter. But this reassertion of racial oppression, by which I mean a reassertion of a kind of racialized underdevelopment of human potential, was much more subtle in the post-integration period, but nevertheless involved defining youth and systematically defining Black youth as undeserving of rehabilitative ideals, as serious delinquents who can be isolated from normal delinquents, the normal delinquents still entitled to some presumptive rights of rehabilitation. The other aspect of the reassertion of sort of a Jim Crow juvenile justice system has to do with the reassertion of racial dominance. And this is a complicated story, maybe we can talk about it in discussion, but the short of it is that there is today unprecedented Black representation among legal authorities. But that representation has lost some meaning in the context of, on the one hand, a juvenile justice system less committed to rehabilitative ideals and less invested in those in terms of resources, but also much more regulated in terms of the use of discretion. So you have these diverse groups of decision makers all under the weight of state mandates and using risk and need calculation instruments and guidelines and so forth. Presumptive waiver, the federalization and nationalization of juvenile justice, disempowering local communities to determine what they need in terms of juvenile justice programs and services. You have deactivated community movements. Black child savers towards the end of the movement are lamenting the disengagement at the local community level. Many African Americans at the local community level are naively thinking that integration is in fact going to facilitate the institutionalization of racial justice, and continued protest and so forth is unnecessary. There are other barriers. Let me just, I'll skip over this, I can come back to this, but let me I wanted to go back to my image, but I'll stop. Let me just stop. And I took that picture at the beginning. At the beginning, because, you know, when I was on my way here this morning on the train, I just was like, I just love the train. I'm like shooting my picture out the window. And I love that picture because it symbolizes, and I promise I'm going to stop. I said, you know, I know you don't believe me, but I promise I'm going to stop. But I just want to talk about this really quickly. It tells really this story in an interesting way. It's a story about, in terms of the movement in New York, a story about migration represented by the railroad, a story about the city in the backdrop, which became so crucial to this movement, and a story about the Hudson. We think about Jane Boland and Poughkeepsie, the protests directed at, and I didn't talk much about Hudson, the protests of Hudson, but they were similarly protesting segregation at Hudson. And finally, the gray skies symbolized to me that the tragedy in the story, the tragedy in the fact that no one ever heard of this, and in the fact that the legacy of the movement is hard to discern today, notwithstanding the fact that this was almost a century-long social movement.
That was Jeff Ward speaking in Hudson about the Jim Crow juvenile justice system. Thanks to his book, The Black Child Savers, and to his presentation, co-sponsored by the Prison Public Memory Project, the story of the movement to address racial disparities in the juvenile justice system and to demand racial justice is finally being told. By knowing the history, we can draw inspiration from the achievements of this movement and learn from its limitations. There is still much to be done to deconstruct racism in the criminal and juvenile justice systems today. For WGXC and the Prison Voices Project, I am Emily Truitt in Hudson, New York.
Check it out. You got the groove. MCs, threes, stand still. Nobody. nobody move unless you're dealing with the next movement. The P5D, we read them on you, man. I live my life nice, but I'm not too big. You theatrical as a four-way play, this ain't rent. 100% straight out the basement, spreading this across the planet on some next shit. How many people feeling this love music? Come on.
That was The Next Movement by The Roots, and you're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Just a reminder to folks out there who might want to join us for the letter writing night for incarcerated listeners. Come on Wednesday, October 30th from 7 to 9 p.m. to 704 Columbia Street at in Hudson, New York, up on the second floor. And from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll be writing letters and folding newsletters and responding to the people who write to the Prison Voices Project from inside of the correctional facilities, the prisons or jails in Greene and Columbia County. And we'll send out a newsletter about all of the great programming to come, as well as information on past shows and topics that we've covered. Speaking about great things to come, our next program is going to focus on the privatization of prisons and feature a special interview with Bob Lebel, who's from Grassroots Leadership and has been speaking nationally about the impact of private prisons on our communities. So please tune in next week. And on Thanksgiving Day, there'll be a Prison Voices Project special focusing on the life of the political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who's a Native American who's been incarcerated for over 3 decades. And his struggle in prison, as well as the struggle that led him to prison. So please tune in when you're doing your cooking or getting ready, maybe going to spend some time with family, or maybe you're working. Tune in from 10 to 11 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day for that Prison Voices Project special program. And then on December 26th, we will feature Calls from Home. And so just as a reminder, Thousand Kites and the Prison Voices Project invite you to participate in a special holiday radio program for prisoners, Calls from Home. Send a message of hope and encouragement to those behind bars in our nation's prisons. Read a short poem, sing a song, or send a blessing. Speak from your heart to the over 2 million people behind bars this holiday season. Your message will be broadcast on radio stations around the country, including the Prison Voices Project, sending radio waves of hope through prison walls. Call in your message to this toll-free number, 877-410-4863. That's 877-410-4863. Or check out callsfromhome.org for more information. Make sure you send that phone call in sometime before December 1st, and we will air that on Thursday, December 26th from 9 to 10 a.m. Thanks so much for listening to the Prison Voices Project. And thank you so much to Emily Truitt, co-producer of today's program. And we will just end with a song by Billie Holiday, once again in theme with the talk by Jeff Ward on the Black Child Savers Movement. This is God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday. Thanks for tuning into the Prison Voices Project, and have a great day.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is new. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains.